Now then, Dimitri, you know how we've always talked about the possibility of something going wrong with the bomb. The bomb, Dimitri. The hydrogen bomb. Well, now, what happened is one of our base commanders, he had a sort of, well, he went a little funny in the head. You know, just a little funny. And he went and did a silly thing. Well, I'll tell you what he did. He ordered his planes to attack your country. Well, let me finish, Dimitri. Let me finish, Dimitri. Well, listen, how do you think I feel about it? Can you imagine how I feel about it, Dimitri? Why do you think I'm calling you? Just to say hello? Of course I like to speak to you. Of course I like to say hello. Not now, but any time, Dimitri. I'm just calling up to tell you something terrible has happened. It's a friendly call. Of course it's a friendly call. Listen, if it wasn't friendly, you probably wouldn't have even got it.
Welcome to Two Old Farts Talk Sci-Fi. I'm David Klenk.
And I'm Troy Harkin.
And this is our Doctor Strangelove episode. We do have a special guest for this episode. Ira Naiman is joining us. And we lovingly refer to him as the third fart.
And I couldn't be happier.
Ira was our special guest for our Season 1, Episode 5 podcast on The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, and our Season 2, Episode 11 podcast on The Adventures of Buckaroo Banzai Across the Eighth Dimension, and our Season 3, Episode 3 podcast on Mystery Men, and our Season 4, Episode 7 podcast on Twiddle Twaddle. And with tonight's appearance, he is the only guest to have appeared in all 5 seasons of the show.
Woo! That sounded like one of those math questions, by the way. Ira Naiman appears on a podcast. If he is on episode 1 of season 4 and blah, blah, blah. Anyway, go ahead.
Well, he was leaving Chicago at 100 miles an hour. Yeah. No, sorry. But he is the second guest to join the Farty 5. Or the Fart Timers Club. The first was Bev Vincent, who joined us for episodes on The Dead Zone and On Writing, and then a three-parter celebrating his book on Stephen King last season. So he's the second person to have appeared in 5 separate episodes. But Ira, you're the only one who's appeared in every season. So Ira, congratulations. And Troy, do we have a jacket or some kind of memento or something to give to Ira?
I do believe we have an extra large gold-plated bottle of Imodium for our guest, of honor.
I will treasure it.
Excellent. Excellent. Whenever, you know, you're in GI distress, just lean on that.
Now, when it comes to a spoiler alert, like we tend to do this, but it is a 1964 film. Do we even do spoiler alerts for films that are over 50 years old?
I guess we need to. If we do one, we should do them all. So,
all right, Troy, will you be so kind as to give us a spoiler alert?
All right, Dimitri, I will push the button now.
This is a test. This station is conducting a test of the emergency broadcast system. This is only a test.
Spoiler alert! Spoiler alert! Spoiler alert!
This is a test of the emergency broadcast system. If this had been an actual emergency, the attention signal you just heard would have been followed by official information, news, or instructions.
There we go. All righty.
Thanks, Troy. We are recording this session via Zoom in the interest of transparency. Troy and I have known Ira for 5 seasons. Oh, and of course, before that, here's a little bit about our guest. Ira Naiman writes humor under the name Ira Naiman. His writing features a heavy dose of satire. The Ugly Truth, his 8th novel with Elsewyn Press, was published in June 2022. His 2 dozenth published short story, Girls Rule the Steampunk World, appeared in Brave New Girls, Chronicles of Misses and Machines. In September 2022, Ira celebrated the 20th anniversary of the weekly publication of Les Pages au Fall, his website of political and social satire. I'm not sure if I butchered that name, Ira.
Damn close. You were good. Yeah.
I tried. Almost good. So anyways, welcome, Ira.
It's great to be here. Great to be back.
So one of the things I like to say is that Two Old Farts Talk Sci-Fi is a look back to when we fell in love with the speculative genre, to recall these times with fondness and affection. And I think a review by Roger Ebert posted October 28th, 1994, about 30 years after the film came out, may have said it best when he said, "Seen after 30 years, Dr. Strangelove seems remarkably fresh and undated, a clear-eyed, irreverent, dangerous satire, and its willingness to follow the situation to its logical conclusion, nuclear annihilation, has a purity that today's lily-livered happy ending technicians would probably find its way around. Its black and white photography helps too, putting an unadorned face on its deadly political paradoxes. If movies of this irreverence, intelligence, and savagery were still being made, the world would seem a younger place." On to Dr. Strangelove. Troy, do you have some background on the movie we're looking at?
I do have a little here. I figure we will save a lot of room for our actual discussion, but here we have it. Some background on Dr. Strangelove. Dr. Strangelove was Kubrick's 7th film, released between Lolita in 1962 and 2001 A Space Odyssey in 1968. As Cold War tensions grew following the Cuban Missile Crisis, Kubrick became obsessed with the possibility of nuclear annihilation. Originally, he looked into developing a serious film on the topic. That took him to the novel Red Alert by Peter George. But the more he examined the absurdity of the topic, the more Kubrick realized that developing the material as a black comedy was the only way to go. As a result, Terry Southern was brought on board to help write the script for Dr. Strangelove. The film was originally slated to open on Thursday, November 22, 1963, but because of the assassination of President Kennedy on that day, the film's premiere was pushed back to January of 1964. Now, I have 2 interesting little synopsises for you. One is from a book I like to go to often just for a laugh, which is the Halliwell's Film Guide of around 1980 or so. And so this is the first one. It says, "A mad USAF general launches a nuclear attack on Russia, and when recall attempts fail and retaliation is inevitable, all concerned sit back to await destruction of the world. Black comedy resolving itself into a series of sketches, with the star playing 3 parts, in parentheses, for no good reason, the U.S. president, an RAF captain, and a mad German-American scientist. Historically an important film in its timing, its nightmares being those of the early 60s, artistically it clogs its imperishable moments by an untidy narrative and unattractively contrasty photography," which seems a little harsh to me, especially given the fact that this was not a review of the time. Certainly enough time had passed that the film was held in pretty high esteem. Now, so that's from, again, Halliwell's Film Guide from circa 1980. Now I'm going to go to 1001 Movies You Must See Before You Die for just a little snippet of what they say. Dr. Strangelove is a brilliant black comedy that works as political satire, suspense farce, and cautionary tale of technology running away with us. Kubrick would return to the potential menace of computer dependency in 2001, to institutional and political violence in A Clockwork Orange, and to the savage, surreal madness of war in Full Metal Jacket. But he never made us laugh this much in any other film. And so again, considered but now, certainly, as one of the 1001 movies you must see. And I know it was also listed, I believe, in the top 20 or so comedies of all time. Dr. Strangelove was nominated for 4 Academy Awards in 1964 and is widely regarded as one of the best comedies ever. It won the Hugo Award for Best Dramatic Presentation. The film also opened the door for other satirical films about the military. Soon after Strangelove's release, we get the films The Russians Are Coming, The Russians Are Coming by Norman Jewison, How I Won the War by Richard Lester, Catch-22 by Mike Nichols, and MASH by Robert Altman. The film was made for $1.8 million and made $9.2 million at the box office. In virtually every metric, the film was a success. Miraculously, 60 years later, we have survived the doomsday machine, and we're here today to discuss Dr. Strangelove, or How I Learned to Stop Worrying and Love the Bomb.
I have long compared Dr. Strangelove to another movie that came out in the same year, about 8 months later, called Failsafe. Now, I don't know if you're familiar with it, but Failsafe and Dr. Strangelove have almost exactly the same plots. American bomber planes are sent to Russia, and there is a lot of tension over whether, in fact, they will drop their bombs somewhere in Russia and start a nuclear war. And I often have used the comparison of these two movies to actually talk about the nature of comedy, because a lot of people think comedy evolves out of plot. But here you have exactly the same plot. One film is a comedy and the other is a drama. And to me, what I always use that as a case study in is how comedy actually arises from your approach to the story and not the story itself. But when I was researching this, I discovered a lot of fascinating interactions between the two movies that I didn't realize before. Kubrick, when he was making Dr. Strangelove and he first heard that Failsafe was also being produced, got his studio, Columbia Pictures, to sue the independent studio that was making Failsafe. And oddly enough, the reason for the lawsuit was that he claimed that the novel Failsafe, on which the movie Failsafe was based, was a plagiarism of Red Alert, was a plagiarized novel of Red Alert. Right. And they actually won that case, oddly enough, but it didn't affect the movie schedule. So what Kubrick did was he went to Columbia and he basically got Columbia to buy out Failsafe. And Columbia sat on the film for 8 months. It wouldn't allow it to be released so that Dr. Strangelove could have the feel to itself. And I think it's unfortunate. Like, the thing about Failsafe is, in and of itself, it was a pretty big movie for its time. It had a major director in Sidney Lumet. It starred Henry Fonda as the president and a fairly young Walter Matthau. And it got buried. Like, by the time it finally came out, people, I don't know if they just had enough of, you know, Cold War atomic bomb films or whatever, but Failsafe in its original run never got the attention that Strangelove got. And it's odd, the last sort of odd thing about it to me is that both films ended up being released by the same studio, Columbia Pictures, even right. though they're largely the same film.
Yeah. Well, I can, you know, I think that may also speak to Kubrick's instincts about turning the script around from a straightforward dramatic narrative into a black satire, because I think in some ways it might be easier for an audience to digest with that element of humor to it, because they were living it. I mean, the three of us all saw the sort of the end of the Cold War and grew up in it. And I think for people who, you know, are say millennials, and didn't live through that era, that stress was incredible. That feeling that at any moment, whatever you were doing could end with a mushroom cloud at your outside of your window and you being vaporized, you know?
Well, and one thing,
sorry, David. Oh, I just wanted to add what you were saying about, it's funny, how you can take a plot basically, and you can filter it either through basically comedy or tragedy. And that's something that, as a horror writer and also as a comic writer, quite often I'll have an idea for a plot, and then it's like, well, if I play it this way, it's funny, but if I play it this way, it's horrific. And I always felt that way about the Three Stooges, in fact. It's like, I never found it funny. It's like, oh my God, he just hit him with a hammer in the head, you know? I guess it all depends on an audience's sensibility. Sorry, what were you going to say, David?
Oh, just about the concept of the time after the Cuban Missile Crisis and how close they came, and bomb shelters and everything else. All of that was hovering over it. I understand, which makes sense why Kubrick would want to do a film based on it. Well, what we want to do is sometimes we like to just look at how we were first introduced to the film. Ira, I don't know if you have a story about how you first saw Dr. Strangelove and how it affected you.
Well, it's really, it's probably not all that interesting. I mean, I saw it on TV when I was a kid, and I even then thought it was hilarious, possibly because I wasn't as affected by the whole Cold War scenario. So I didn't feel that my life was potentially over at any second. So I could appreciate the comedy elements more. If that makes sense.
And Troy, do you have any memories of first seeing it?
Well, like Ira, I probably saw it on TV, and I probably saw it on City TV's Great Movies. And I'm not sure that prior to watching it this week that I ever saw it from start to finish. There was something about the segmented scenes, you know, basically dividing the film into thirds, that always allowed me an out, you know, when a scene would end. So I probably saw the whole thing, you know, in sections through my life, but never until recently in one go. And it was generally those Peter Sellers scenes, because, you know, I grew up with all of the Pink Panther films, you know, him playing Clouseau, and films like The Party, and loving his sort of like his broad stuff. And then much later seeing Being There. So it was generally Peter Sellers that kept me in it. But yeah, it was great finally seeing it in one sitting from beginning to end, and appreciating that inner cutting, and, you know, really appreciating seeing like James Earl Jones in his film debut. How about you, David?
I have a feeling that we might all be in sort of the same boat of just watching it on TV, because we're not that old where we would have seen it back in 64, I would have been 2 years old, which is a bit young. Like imagine your parents saying, oh, let's bring our 2-year-old Davey to see Dr. Strangelove. I think he'll just absolutely love it. And I might have loved it. I may not remember it, but definitely in the 70s, I would have seen it, and probably on the same, TV that gave us like four choices. All bad. But one thing I wanted to know, Ira, because you're sort of our resident expert on satires, how do you think this fits in with with, you know, things like the Lady Killers and some of these other, you know, the great satires and some of the ones that you've even been a guest on our show. Like, what do you think?
Well, you know, Troy and I were talking before we started recording about the tonal shifts in the film. And they're really sort of brought out in the performances, how you have sort of the gonzo performances of, say, the Dr. Strangelove character or George C. Scott's character, which is, you know, kind of over the top, overacting kind of performances. But then you get the kind of understated deadpan performances of Sterling Hayden, for instance, or actually one of my favorite bits is the Keenan Wynn scene. He's only in one scene of the film, but oh my God, he is so intense and serious in that scene, right?
Yeah.
And the thing is that both styles work as comedy, right? I mean, when Sterling Hayden starts talking about preserving America's precious bodily fluids, but with that, actually, that very famous Kubrick shot of from beneath, below, where you're looking at him, kind of tower, his face towering over you, and he's so seriously, he has such seriousness of purpose. It's hilarious, right? Whereas George C. Scott, to use the other example, when George C. Scott is, you know, going on about, well, you know, so maybe 30 million people will die, maybe 50 million people will die. It depends on the breaks, right?
We might get our hair mussed.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. And that is a different comedic approach, but one that also works. In particular with Scott's character, I think that kind of the purpose of it was to show just how childlike or even childish the people who are making these decisions of life or death over millions of people are, right? Kind of a commentary on the whole military mindset. Now, there's something else that feeds into that too, and I may be wandering a bit, so I hope you'll indulge me there. But there is an undercurrent of sexuality to the film that starts with the opening credit sequence, mm-hmm. where you have a bomber plane that is being refueled in flight, right?
Inseminated.
And I mean, yeah, exactly, exactly. And, you know, there's a very actually telling line in the film where Sterling Hayden, who is the general who sends the bomber planes to Russia, he's talking about, you know, fluoride sapping the precious bodily fluids out of people. And at one point, he actually says that I have denied women my essence, right? Which is a suggestion that he is impotent, basically, and that the whole attack on Russia is him playing out his masculinity, right? And of course, you've got, you know, Slim Pickens riding the bomb, which is just obvious phallic symbolism. So you've got this equation of male impotence with military action, which I think is not always subtle, but is always there.
Yeah, I think that Kubrick really nails that. And the thing is, you know, it's not even, we even get it in the title, right? It's strange love. It's basically, we're talking about kink, right? Because it's not even straightforward sex. It's all sort of filtered through a kinky filter. And which is something that I've sort of always said about America. It's like, it's got an issue, a Freudian issue with phalluses, right? It's all about guns and missiles and rockets, which, you know, like, it doesn't take much to figure that one out, right? It's like, get comfortable with that, folks. Get comfortable with sex the way you are with weaponry and warfare, and you'll be much happier.
Although I do think it does occur to me that, I mean, it's obvious to us now. In 1964, it might have been revelatory.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yes. I mean, and again, we were talking a little bit about the genius of Kubrick. Like, yeah, he was far ahead of the curve, you know, and we were even saying, like, perhaps part of his whole being a master chess player also works into his body of work, because when you go film to film, you can't figure him out. Like, you go, how is this the same filmmaker? You know, this guy who just did Spartacus and now he's doing like Lolita. And now he's doing this thing about the Cold War. like what, I can't keep up. Speaking of that, speaking a little bit of his body of work, I'm going to put this to you, Ira, and then, you know, David and I can chime in a little bit if we like. But yeah, where would you personally, where does this fit among your favorite Kubrick films? Not necessarily the best, but in terms of what you like.
It's pretty high up there. It's pretty high up there. Now, one thing I will say, and I don't know that this is a very sort of popular opinion, but I think that Kubrick is almost always a satirical filmmaker. There are strains of comedy and there are strains of satirical comedy in just about everything that he does. So in that sense, Strangelove fits very comfortably with the rest of his films. In terms of, you know, favorites, 2001 is like one of my favorite films of all time. So this will be just below that. But I also think that Lolita is actually a really interesting experiment in adaptation. I'm not sure that Nabokov's book is actually adaptable, but he gives it a really good go. And again, you know, talking about a film that isn't usually seen as satirical, but I think definitely has that streak in it. Clockwork Orange. Thank you. Clockwork Orange, is really social satire, and works very well too. So, I mean, yeah, it fits in with some of my favorite, Kubrick films for sure.
Yeah, there are even elements of The Shining that I always figured he's going for, not laughs, but as you say, like satire. You know, when you even the famous scene with Jack and Wendy on the stairs in The Shining, you know, it's so over the top that one can't help but laugh at it, even if it's an uncomfortable laughter. There are just things that he does. And you know that it's always calculated with Kubrick. Like, nothing happens by accident. What about you, David? Do you have, where would you put this among your favorite Kubrick films?
I would probably put it, just like Ira, second behind 2001. Now, I did like, I guess it's called Full Metal Jacket, right? Or Heavy Metal Jacket. Full Metal Jacket. Which was kind of interesting because I don't know what I was when I ate at it, but at the end of the film, I got rather sick.
Well, Ira has the Imodium if you'd like some.
Yeah, I might have to
We'll go back in time and get that to you.
Because I remember seeing it with my sister Pat, and I think there was a scene early on where they're pouring something over the graves. And maybe it was something that I ate, but Dr. Strangelove is a very close second, but you know, there could be arguments for it being even number one. And certainly I think it's more of a satire than 2001 is. So as a satirical film, I'm not sure if there are that many famous satires are even better than it. It pretty much, you know, is the one of the greatest satirical films of all time. One thing I wanted to mention that Ira, that you were mentioning about, is sometimes people are a bit steadfast or a bit, even Keenan Wynn's character as Bat Guano, he plays it pretty intense and pretty much straight up. And that whole scene about the Coca-Cola company,
that is one of my favorite lines in the film. I know everybody remembers the line, "Gentlemen, you can't fight in here. This is the war room," right? A very famous line. But one of my favorite lines is Keenan Wynn saying, and incredibly intensely. It's really into this idea. Okay, I'm going to shoot off the lock of the cola machine, but if you don't talk to the president, you're going to have to answer to the Coca-Cola company. Right? And it's just like his priorities. Like, he says that as the world is about to be destroyed, right? It's just, it's a perfect line, perfectly delivered.
Also slapstick, because he bends down yeah. to get the coins, and the water, of course, the cola comes out and hits him in the face, which is just perfect yeah. to end that scene.
Yeah.
One thing I did want to mention before I forget is that this kind of thing, you know, Peter Sellers is a genius. Kubrick just loved working with him. A lot of these scenes were sort of almost off script or just things he was doing. This thing, this condition that he had, which just sounded like something made up about him, his not being able to control his arms or his legs.
Yeah.
And there's this, I had never noticed this until I watched it like three times this week in prep for the episode, is that he's in the war room and he's doing that whole Nazi thing, and he's Dr. Strangelove, and he can't control his arm. And if you look at the expression, you're just concentrating on him, but if you look at the expression of everyone else around, Peter Bull as the Soviet ambassador is cracking up. Like, he can't keep a straight face. It's like Harvey Korman when you've got
Robert,
whoever yeah. it is. It's, just breaking him up. Like, it's just hilarious.
Well, yeah. here's like, the thing mm-hmm. about that. As has been mentioned, Kubrick was a perfectionist, and he really planned every shot ahead of actually shooting. But for Dr. Strangelove, he let Peter Sellers improvise on the set, which is actually extremely rare for him. And just about everything Sellers did as Strangelove was not in the script. And in fact, there is a story how he got the black glove. Apparently, Kubrick had a pair of black gloves that he wore on the set, because Kubrick liked to move the lights to get exactly the right lighting in a shot. And he wore these gloves because he moved around the lights. He wore these gloves so as not to burn his hands. And Peter Sellers saw this, and he's like, I can use that glove. Can I borrow one of your gloves for this scene? And that's where Strangelove got the glove, right? But so I'm totally not surprised that people were cracking up on the set, because Sellers was improvising madly.
One of the things that struck me today and then just started to eat away at my brain was this thing that Kubrick seems to have going throughout his films, especially his sort of later films, maybe starting with Strangelove, but the whole idea of the failure of systems and the failure to communicate, and what becomes of that. And we see it obviously in 2001. We definitely see it in Strangelove, because that's the whole sort of motivating factor in the film, is not being able to be in touch with the B-52s after Jack D. Ripper causes this mayhem. And of course, in The Shining, we get Jack destroys the CB radio at the Overlook Hotel. And so then they're no longer able to, you know, communicate with the outside world. We also see Ripper's notebook that looks like something Jack Torrance might have written if he didn't have a typewriter. You know, you can imagine, rather than the, what is it, the essence? The poem. Yeah,
there's purity of essence. Of essence and peace on earth, the POEs.
And with Jack, I just realized they're both Jacks, a Jack Ripper and a Jack Torrance. And with Torrance, it's the, what is it, all work and no play makes Jack a dull boy, over and over again. Anyway, I don't know if you have anything you want to add there. Ira, it's not actually a question, unfortunately, but if you want to maybe turn it into like a Jeopardy type thing, if you have anything to add on there, feel free.
Oh, I think there are details that we can, you know, make connections to various Kubrick films. I think Kubrick had a very specific vision, and he keeps coming back to, you know, specific visuals over and over again.
Yeah.
There's also some great line, like a few of the lines, like, and it's all satire and it's all really dark and understated and complete. But like when he says it looks like General Ripper exceeded his authority, I was thinking that's stunning. And just the look of the president, you know, he's just sort of thinking, who the hell am I talking to? It's just brilliant. You know, that these little lines of George C. Scott, like the human element has failed us here.
Yeah,
as you said, you can't fight in the war room and all that stuff. What was one of the things I found fascinating was Dr. Strangelove, his first line that the first time he speaks is about 51 minutes into the film. I actually thought it was 51 minutes and 10 seconds in a 95 minute film is the first time he speaks a line. They kept him right till the end and it was just a perfect added oomph. You know, he's sort of like that person who comes in the third act and just adds more invigoration, adds more energy to the movie.
Yeah. And, you know, Strangelove, this is another thing too that I love about this film. And, you know, as satirists, which we've all sort of delved in that area, when you get these sort of Dickensian names, these names that are hilarious in themselves, but also sort of like seem to tip you off to the characters. So you get like Mandrake and Muffly. I love Muffly.
Kiss Off.
Yeah. Dmitri Kissoff. But even like, because as kids, and I guess it came from the 60s, but I remember as the 70s, you would say something like, oh, he muffed it up, you know? and so you get like a Merkin Muffly. It's hilarious.
Yeah. And I was sort of and watching it a Kong. Number of times. Yeah. Yes. Kong, of course. I was taken more with Tracy Reed as Miss Scott,
mm-hmm.
As the secretary who is wants to possibly become Mrs. Buck Turgeson. And just that whole phone conversation where he's off in the distance, you don't even see where he is. And she keeps trying to communicate and hold the person. It's just done so well.
Yeah. And even, you know, clearly Strangelove is like a veiled Werner von Braun. But the fact that he comes from Germany and he's changed his name to Strangelove, but basically it's just a translation, a German translation, his actual name, whatever Strangelove is, something Lieb. Yeah. Anyway, any thoughts on the naming there, Ira? I guess, now, is it true that most of that was the work of
Harry Southern?
Yeah.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. There was a making of documentary on the DVD that I watched the film on recently. And one of the things they pointed out was that it was not difficult to figure out what came from Kubrick and what came from Terry Southern. So just to use the title, Dr. Strangelove came from Terry Southern. How I Stopped Worrying and Learned to Love the Bomb came from Kubrick. Kind of tells you all you need to know about the different approaches. This is part of the Kubrick's brilliance, right? Hmm. He wants to write a comedy. He doesn't quite know how to get the tone right. So he gets one of the best writers of comedy at the time, Terry Southern, to come in to punch up the script. And he allows one of the best performers of comedy of the time, Peter Sellers, to improvise, right? So you've got these things going that that really add to the depth of the comedy. I'll also say, because David brought this up, the film is about 90 minutes long, but it's so full. There's so much going on. It is a Kubrick film in the sense that every shot counts. There is absolutely no fat on it whatsoever.
Yeah, even the ending where they're going through all of these, some of the military people at the time were thinking, okay, how do they know all this stuff? Because they're going through everything you have to do to drop the bomb. That was one of the two things that I mentioned to you guys earlier that I had a bit of a question about. The first one was, because I had actually find years ago, like 20, 30 years ago, even when I was watching the film, I was thinking, it would just seemed a bit odd near the end because they said they were 10 miles out. And considering how fast these planes, these bombers fly, if you're going like a car at 60 miles per hour, as an example, then you go 60 miles an hour, which is 1 mile a minute. If you're going 600, you're doing 10 miles every minute. And when they said they were 10 miles out, I thought, well, they're going to be there in about a minute or two. 4 minutes later, they're 8 miles out. And then so on. And then it becomes fat. Like if you actually follow, it wouldn't have been that complicated for them to actually have figured all that stuff out and put a proper number on it because the math didn't add up. That was just one of two concerns. The other one was just the very ending where they were just talking about going to underground mine shafts and going deep enough and they would have to get food there. They'd have 10 women for every man and they would decide that the military and the politicians would be saved. And they're working out all of this stuff, but the bombs are being dropped. How much time does it take to eventually get these mine shafts set up for human habitation, select the people and get them down there? So that part I didn't quite understand.
Well, I do think that, you know, you have to suspend your disbelief for a lot of stuff like that. But the one thing I will say is that the ending, although I like it a lot, was not the original ending of the film. The film was supposed to end with a pie fight in the war room. And this is actually set up very early in the film where when the Russian ambassador is first introduced, he's introduced at this very long table with a lot of food on it, including a lot of pies, right? So, I mean, that was there. And they actually, like, my original thinking was, or my original, originally I thought, I had heard somewhere that the reason that they didn't use the pie scene in the end was because there was a line in the pie scene where somebody goes, "Oh my God, the president has been hit," presumably with a pie, which tends not to be funny after JFK is assassinated, right? But actually, I was disabused of that notion by the documentary. Apparently, the studio never liked the pie fight scene as an ultimate scene in the film. They gave Kubrick one chance to shoot it. He shot it once, and the problem was all of the actors were cracking up. They were just having too much of a good time. They were having too much fun, and he couldn't use that take. So the actual ending of the film that we get was kind of a last-minute thing that's put together. But, you know, for me, when I think it's General Turgidson who goes, you know, what we can't have is a mine shaft gap, right? And it totally, it brilliantly encapsulates all of the military thinking that the movie is making fun of, right? Yeah. So it does work very well for me.
And for, what I was thinking, David, was that planning that they're discussing is all a part of the denial that goes hand in hand with thinking that you can survive a nuclear war. You remember, this is the same mindset that told school children that, you know, like you see the mushroom cloud, you stop, drop and roll and go under your desk and you'll be fine. You know, so for me, I thought that was great. And it was actually, it's part of the satire even that, you know, and they're like, yeah, that'll be great. And we're sort of like, now that you've told us about the women, we're really going to sign off on this, like bring on the bomb. so, yeah, I was okay with that.
Well, some of the stuff that is so cool, guys, is that they play it also straight up, which is what satire does well. Like the fact that they did all that stuff that is all the stuff that a military person would do when they received the order and Kong has to go back and take a look at it. Then he says, contact them and actually see, you contact the base and see if you can confirm it with someone on the phone. And then they do that. It reminds me a bit of War Games at the very beginning where they had this scenario where are they actually going to pull the trigger, whether it's a test or not, or in the movie Crimson Tide, where it's always a question of if you're going to send off something, you want to know, you want that confirmation because you don't want to be that person that starts World War III.
Well, that's interesting because, of course, the military absolutely had nothing to do with the making of the film. The Air Force, the American Air Force, absolutely refused to do anything to help make the film. And in fact, the interior of the plane, the cockpit of the plane, and all of the interior was actually developed because of one photograph, I think it was in Time magazine, that was of the forward part of the cockpit of an actual B-52. What Kubrick did was he told his set designers, okay, take that and extrapolate it to the rest of the plane, right? And in fact, the whole sequence that they go through, pressing all the buttons and everybody sort of talking about what they're doing and agreeing to doing it and stuff, the Air Force said, no, that's not the way it works. Don't be getting any science lessons from this movie, right?
And supposedly, I guess internally, the Air Force freaked out when they did see the film. And they're like, how did they get this detail right?
Yeah,
you know, they assumed that somehow they had insiders sending them images, but they didn't.
Well, one other thing I just wanted to bring up, because back when I was an undergrad and we looked at this film, my professor actually brought this to my attention. It's still the only film that I know of, and there may actually be other examples, but it's the only one that I know of that takes place in three different locations where none of the characters in any of the locations interact with any of the other characters in the other locations.
Right.
Right. You've got the Pentagon. You've got the war room at the Pentagon. You've got the plane. And you've got Berthelsen Air Force Base. And it's incredible that even though, you know, the characters don't interact, their actions affect what the people in the other locations are doing.
Yeah. And that's really the way life works.
Yes.
You know, you get those interconnections, but it's not always the way we would do it dramatically, you know, but like say something like a parcel arriving, you may not see the guy who delivers the parcel, but he's got a whole backstory. And then you get the parcel, you know, there's all these sort of interconnections that aren't actually people dealing with one another.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, no, it's brilliant that way, because even as you started, I thought, well, maybe it's a little like an Altman film, but Altman characters tend to interact. So you're right. Yeah, it is to be noted for sure.
Yeah, and who keeps this huge gun in a golf bag?
A man named Jack the Ripper does.
Because that's just weird. And he keeps some of the ammo actually in the side thing where you keep golf balls.
Yeah.
He's got these things.
Now, what I wondered was the whole thing about the fluoride. Now, that's a conspiracy theory that I'd heard growing up. And I thought, so did that conspiracy theory come from the film, or is it probably, knowing Kubrick, it's something that he took that he had actually heard, that there are people talking about this fluoride stuff?
It's not necessarily an either or situation.
Yeah, right.
It might have been, you know, nascent in the culture, and then it appears in the movie, which disseminates it to a whole new group of people, right?
Right. Yeah. And I'm amazed.
It sounds like today, doesn't it, Troy? Yeah, like the right kinds of things that people say about what the vaccines cause and everything else. It sounds like the same thing.
Yeah. Well, if you ever see the, I'll put in air quotes, documentary Room 217. It's an interesting view, because, you know, they basically have all of these conspiracy theories based on The Shining, you know, none of which, you know, certainly I ever heard Kubrick espouse, but, you know, it's certainly a fascinating watch. So like Ira said, though, it's like, you know, it's hard to tell which came first, the chicken or the egg, with some of these ideas.
Yeah, the quote is, do you realize that fluoridation is the most monstrously conceived and dangerous communist plot we have ever faced? Come on.
Yeah, and what maybe is the line? I do not deny them. I do not deny them my essence. Is that the quote? Yeah.
Well, the quote here is, women sense my power and they seek the life essence. I do not avoid women, Mandrake, but I do deny them my essence. Now, that's the scene, that whole scene where he's actually sitting on the couch next to him, puts his arm around the Brigadier, and he's sort of like, and he seems so uncomfortable in that. It's just a wonderful scene.
Yeah. If we're not careful, we're all going to have to answer to the Coca-Cola company.
Well, you know, this just reminds me of just how much detail is in the film, and so much makes it so worth multiple screenings, like watching it many times. For instance, at least three or four times, there are shots where there is a sign or a poster or something that says peace is our profession.
Yeah.
Right.
Yes.
And especially when the Air Force base is being attacked from outside. Right. And so you've got peace is our profession very clearly there while gunfire is going back and forth. Right.
Yeah. You may not be very good at your job.
I must have seen the movie like a dozen times, and I didn't know until I actually saw it on the DVD that the woman in General Turgeon's bedroom, his secretary.
Miss Scott, yeah.
Miss Scott was the Playboy playmate that Colonel Kong was looking at in the first time we see him on screen. I did not know that was the same woman.
Me neither. Yeah, Miss Foreign Affairs, because you see it just over her body, that there's this magazine with Miss Foreign Affairs.
Yeah. And another sort of takeaway for me was, and involves Turgeon as well, is you know, when he's in the war room, there's a binder where the spine faces the camera, and it, I forget the full title of it, but it has Megadeth on it. And I was like,
that's right.
Megadeth, is this like, that must be the first sort of pop culture getting it out there, because maybe it existed within the military culture. I don't know, but must be where the band got it.
That speech where he talks about, you know, 30 million or maybe 40 million dead or whatever, that speech was actually taken from a Rand Corporation position paper.
Wow. Right?
He is spouting satirically what was actually being studied at the time. And yes, the Rand Corporation actually came up with the term Megadeth.
Wow.
But you're right. The film is the first one that popularizes it.
I'm actually not going to say the city, I probably have in the past, but I live north of Toronto, and we have, it's not actually a Diefenbunker, but it's a type of Diefenbunker that was intended for Toronto municipal workers to come to once the bomb hit. It's a lead lined building, and in the basement of it, they have, you know, one of those plexiglass maps boards. And on it, it has every major Canadian city listed down one side, and the number of, doesn't say mega deaths, but just the number of deaths within each of these major Canadian cities. It's chilling.
Mm-hmm. And that's the point. That's the point of the satire. It's like, they're very calmly talking about massive amounts of death, tens of millions of people dying. And to the Rand Corporation and the politicians who are reading those studies, it's just numbers. It's you know, meaningless in many ways.
Just getting your hair mussed.
Yeah, exactly. And what is acceptable and all that stuff.
Yeah.
One of the things that I liked, we're almost ready to go to the Dreamcast and Schrodinger's cast, but the whole scene, like George C. Scott's brilliant. And I loved him in Patton. He won an Oscar for Patton, but Patton's one of my favorite films. It's just such a standout performance in it. And he's pretty amazing in this. So when he's quoting general that sent the bombs in, and Ripper. And he says, so let's get going. There's no other choice. So God willing, we will prevail in peace and freedom from fear and in true health through the purity and essence of our natural fluids. God bless you all. And that's, I think, just, yeah, you know that this guy has definitely gone a bit too far, I think. Just a tad.
Just a little.
As a genre guy, I also have to do a tip of the hat to George C. Scott for Exorcist III and The Changeling, two of my favorite horror films of sort of a certain era. Do you want me to hit you quickly with the Beatlesisms, David?
Yeah.
All righty. So definitely there are connections to Peter Sellers through the Beatles. John Lennon and the other Beatles were huge fans of the Goons, the British comedy troupe that Peter Sellers had been in. Ringo starred with Peter Sellers in The Magic Christian and Candy, both films based on novels by Terry Southern. And in Peter Jackson's Get Back documentary, we see Peter Sellers dropping by Twickenham Studios and hanging out with the Beatles. And I learned one just before we started recording, and that is, in 1967, some of the flying footage from Dr. Strangelove was reused in the Beatles' Magical Mystery Tour. Supposedly, the use of the footage prompted Kubrick to call editor Roy Benson to complain, because I guess he actually didn't give his permission for that. And flying footage from The Shining was used at the end of Blade Runner in 1982, just connecting that those dots. And there you go. That's your Beatlesism for today.
Ira, do you have anything before we get to the Dreamcasting? Sometimes we like to ask our guests if there's anything that you may have picked up or not been aware of with Dr. Strangelove that you may have picked up in the last, say, 5 or 10 years that might have been surprised you or something you just weren't aware of.
Well, I think I've talked a little bit about some of the details that came out in this particular viewing. Like I say, there's so much going on all of the time that it's easy to find new things, no matter how many times you've seen the film.
It's a film that stands up to repeated viewing.
Absolutely.
Yep. Troy, did we want to do our Dreamcasting and Schrodinger's cast?
Dreamcasting. Yeah. Dreamcasting, baby.
Now we're doing a bit of a condensed version today. Is that right, David?
Yeah, we're looking at just Peter Sellers, because there's this long history of actors, and it's almost like a feather in your cap. Like it's something where you play multiple roles, and there's even something on Wikipedia or some site I found that lists you. All you have to do is just Google actors or actresses that have played multiple roles, and there are so many over time. There's some famous ones, but we thought Peter Sellers was in 3 roles. Why don't we find someone to replace Peter, even though he's irreplaceable?
Sure, yeah.
And exactly. Do that with the Dreamcast and Schrodinger's cast.
Sure. Do we want Ira to lead off as our guest?
I'm ready. I can do this.
All right, you can do it, Ira.
I can do it. I am strong.
Yeah.
You
have the essence among you with your bodily fluids.
And I'm willing to share it, which
okay, all right.
As soon as it comes out, it sounds wrong.
Oh, we're all preverts anyway.
There you go. So for my dream, I had a feeling that somebody else would take the obvious one, and you have. I'm not going to spoil that. For my dream, I would suggest Jimmy Stewart.
Oh.
Yeah. He could obviously play the president very well. I think when you look at some of his work with Alfred Hitchcock, he could get the craziness of Strangelove, right? Mm-hmm. I don't know if he could do the British accent of the third part, but he certainly has the range. I think he could have done it very well.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I'm a big Stewart fan, so I'll give it a shot with Jimmy. Shall I give you mine, David?
Sure.
Okay. Well, I went with somebody who has a background in sketch comedy, as Peter Sellers did, and somebody who I quite like his work recently, and that's Bill Hader. And I thought, you know, he could definitely get into different characters, and I would love to see him do Strangelove for sure. And I could also imagine him doing Muffly. You know, don't know if the British accent would fly either with Mandrake, but I'm going with Bill Hader for my dream cast.
Okay, so we got Bill Hader, and I have Sir Alec Guinness, who has been known for playing the occasional multiple characters in the film. And excellent. I think he would just be perfect. And that, of that age, even like around 64, he would have been about the right age to even play that role.
Yeah.
Ira, do you have like an outside, a very odd, and I do appreciate what your choice are. I think this is, but Peter Sellers is Peter Sellers. And there's no, I mean, you know, if you think of some of the great comedians that have been around, for like Robin Williams and some of the roles that he can play serious and also play funny, and Sacha Baron Cohen, and so there have been just so many great actors and comedians that you can almost pick anyone. I like these choices, and Bill Hader probably has the most of those three, the most comic chops.
I was about to change my mind, but I'm doing bad typos on my phone here. I just realized who I should have picked, even though I do love Bill Hader and I will stick to it. But now that I think about it, Taika Waititi would also have been excellent as in the three different roles, and hilarious. So if Bill is sick, if he breaks his leg, as supposedly Peter Sellers did or didn't on the set, you know, maybe he can come in for a role.
I've actually seen photos of Sellers with his leg
with a cast. Yeah.
So, yeah.
Yeah.
I had originally thought, sorry for the digression.
It's okay.
I had originally thought Sellers was supposed to play Major Kong as well. And I had originally thought that he didn't, because he couldn't master the Texan accent.
Right.
But I was wrong. Apparently what happened was that there was a scene that they were shooting where Major Kong jumps from the cockpit into the bomb bay, and Sellers broke his leg doing that stunt. And Kubrick couldn't, you know, wait for 3 weeks or however long it took him to heal, so he had to recast the part. That's how Slim Pickens got the role.
And I don't know, I heard a variation of that story, don't know if it's true or not, but it was told on the Criterion Collection, where supposedly he and Kubrick were having a heated discussion while he was on the bomb, while he was sitting on the bomb, and was quite animated and fell off of it. Now, I don't know if that's true or not, right? I'm just telling you what I heard. I could use the Trumpian phrase, people are saying. Anyway, yes. Okay, so where are we at, David? We're going on to Schrodinger's cast?
Yeah, and I guess we'll start with Ira first, since I guess we started with him.
Well, he's our guest. He's an honored guest, too. So
5 times.
Yeah.
You
have to say baby afterwards. 5 times, baby. That's staying power.
Okay, this might seem like an odd choice.
It should.
The whole point, I suppose. I was thinking Peter Lorre. Now, the thing about Strangelove is he is one creepy dude. And he really is. When you strip him of the comedy, he is like, ugh.
Yeah.
And Peter Lorre can totally nail that.
Yes.
I also think that Peter Lorre is very underrated as an actor. I think that he could, he's got kind of a silky smooth side that people don't give him credit for. So he could certainly have finessed the president. Again, I don't know if he could do the British accent, especially because of his pronounced German accent. So not sure how he would fare as Mandrake, but yeah, I think it would work. I think he could make it work.
That's a great choice. Oh, well, yeah. As you may or may not know, that with Schrodinger's cast, I, over the last year or so, have been using my random name generator 9000 software to come up with my candidates for Schrodinger's cast. So for Mandrake, President Mifflin, and Strangelove, the random name generator 9000 gave me Jane Mansfield.
Wow. Yeah, without that, I think I've said this before, without that random name generator, you may never have in 1,000 years picked Jane Mansfield as the person that you would have.
Nope. Oh, I'm sure, unless I was like having a seizure or starting a stroke or something. Yeah.
Yeah. And no offense, of course, against Jane Mansfield.
No,
just don't think.
No.
But that's about as outside the box as you can get.
Yeah. Yeah. It certainly isn't stereotyping.
You can see the box from your backyard. But anyway, sorry. I can see Russia from my house. But one thing I was thinking of originally was my first choice was Jim Carrey originally as someone that could play a lot of roles and has enough of rubber faces and looks different in different roles. And then I was thinking Mike Myers because did that with Austin Powers. He played several different characters in that. But I finally settled on someone that's completely out there, which is Tom Cruise. Who, and I don't want to spoil Tropic Thunder, but which is, I think, one of the more underrated comedies of the last 20 years. It's quite brilliant. But it wasn't until the credits at the end of the film that I realized that there was a certain character in that film played by Tom Cruise. And it was kind of stunning. Like I just said, how the hell? That's Tom Cruise? and he could do the character, I think, you know, dressed up and with whatever they've done with him, I think Tom Cruise would work well for that. Well, I think that might be our Dr. Strangelove episode.
Yeah. And with any luck, we will meet again.
So thanks to our special guest. Oh, well done, Troy. Well done. I almost can hear Vera Lynn's voice.
I considered singing it, but I thought I better not.
I'll meet again, dude. Okay, so thanks. Thank you, Ira.
Yeah, thanks very much, Ira.
Always a lot of fun. Thank you for having me.
Okay, everybody, please remember to catch us on all of our socials. Try your favorite podcast provider. Some of them are coming and going these days, so it's hard to keep track, but we are definitely on Spotify, and you can go to our website, which is 2of.ca, and Facebook. Yes, we're there. We like to go there and play and have comments and share silly things and welcome your feedback. So please check us out on Facebook at Two Old Farts Talk Sci-Fi, and do tell a friend, like and subscribe, and all of those things.
I am David Klink.
And I am Troy Harkin.
See you all for our next episode of Two Old Farts
Talk Sci-Fi.
The Office of Civil Defense has issued the following message. This is an attack warning. Repeat, this is an attack warning. Attack warning means that an actual attack against this country has been detected and that protective action should be taken. This is an emergency action notification. All broadcast stations shall broadcast emergency action notification message number 2 Red card. This station has interrupted its regular program at the request of the United States government to participate in the emergency broadcast system. During this period, some stations will stay on the air as part of the emergency broadcast system. Those stations will broadcast news and information for the general public in the assigned areas. You should now tune your radio dial until you hear a station which is broadcasting news and information for your area. Until further notice, this station will not be broadcasting news and information for your area. I repeat, this station will not be broadcasting news and information for your area until further notice. You should now tune your radio dial until you hear a station which is broadcasting news and information for your area.